week vacation in Europe, Vienna and Prague, and I've been flashing my phone screen at people for the last 5 days, showing them castles and museums and rivers. And so I'll do a little travelogue and we'll have a little Dharma discussion, and I'm still very much in that traveling glow, vacation glow. I brought Reb Anderson's Third Turning of the Wheel along with me, and it's commentary on the Samdhanir Mochana Sutra, so I brought a copy of that and to kind of read and study on my trip. So I really want to thank Reb for this great book explaining the Yogacara school. I want to thank Kokyo because we did a lot of study here over the last couple of years in the Yogacara school. So it really kind of opened up a new area of study, new area of interest for me. So I want to thank both Kokyo and Reb for that. So I never stray too far from talking about the non-separation, the interconnectedness of all the universe, and I think you see it pretty clearly in Europe, maybe a little more than here. You know, everybody speaks at least two languages there. After a few days, I sort of stopped asking people if they spoke English because everybody did, and I just launched right into English, and it was pretty seamless. You know, it's kind of a, you know, organic that they're speaking so many languages. You know, it just seems like there's another country and another culture and another language just over the next hill. You know, the countries are small. You can travel from one place to another pretty easily. You know, the train ride between Vienna and Prague is 4 hours long. You know, what is that? Kind of between here and Santa Barbara. And in that train ride, you go through three countries and three languages. And so, you know, people are traveling through borders pretty fluidly. I mean, at least now they are. And so you know people from other cultures speaking other languages. And you and so that's why it's so it's kind of necessary to learn other cultures and learn other languages. The train systems just seem to go so fluidly all over Europe, over borders, over mountains. So there really is this feeling of non-separation. You know, that's the unity side of things. But the flip side, of course, is, you know, I'm not the expert on the Czech Republic or Slovakia, but it seems to me that they got along pretty well as one country for 60 or so years. So what's the big deal? How come now they need to be two countries? Their languages are a little different, but not quite the same, but easily understood. But so as much as, you know, people fluidly go from one place to the other, ultimately the Czech Republic and Slovakia decided to be two countries. And of course that we see that all over Europe. You know, the Balkan states are now many different countries where they used to be one. Certainly there's a big separatist movement in Spain. I mean, I think there's at least four separatist movements in Spain. The whole British Isles with England and Ireland and Wales and Scotland. There are certainly people in all of those quarters that would like to define their culture and their language, you know, with more fixed borders rather than one country. So, you know, right there in Europe, where I've just bragged about their comfort with intimacy and unity, there's still a strong current there of, you know, let's celebrate our differences as well with more defined borders. So that's, you know, I get to practice with that as well. I think I spoke a few months ago about an earlier part of the Samdhanir Mochana Sutra, this sutra of revealing the secrets. You know, where Reb makes a suggestion when we're trying to study the three characteristics of all phenomena. This one characteristic, the other dependent characteristic, is really the accepting the causes and conditions, the dependent co-arising in each moment, you know, for every bit of phenomena. But to try to understand that, he suggested that we just receive our life. We try to accept everything. We try to take it in, at least so we can look at it a little bit, not be so ready to reject anything that comes to our life, but to just receive our life, to try to get us to understand that, oh, here's another cause and condition that's arising in this moment along with me. So if this other dependent quality is a part of all of these things that we're trying to sort of say, you know, I'm here and that cushion is over there. The separation that we perceive, why not try to just receive our life, get it a little closer, see that everything is arising in this moment together, to see if that doesn't help us discover a little more intimacy with the universe. If you know, Buddha said that he teaches a liberation from suffering, and then goes on to define suffering as this idea that there are separate things in the universe. So if liberation of suffering is to appreciate the intimacy and the interconnectedness of all things, and to question the separation of things, then this practice of just receiving our life, receiving all the causes and conditions, is the perfect expression of the total dynamic functioning of the universe. This practice of receiving our life is liberation from suffering. So that's how it's discussed earlier on in the book, or earlier on in the sutra. As we try to analyze all phenomena. That comes to mind this experience I had in Prague. My hotel just happened to be a block from the opera house, and so I went to four operas on my trip. One in Vienna and three in Prague, because it was just so handy, and it's a lot cheaper there than going to the San Francisco Opera, so I felt like it was a real doable thing. And it was La Traviata, three acts, one opera, three acts, so two intermissions, and beautiful opera house, smaller than San Francisco Opera, but beautiful and old, and about four stories of balconies and boxes and seats, and so every seat was good. Every seat was just sort of seemed like it was right on top of the stage, and so at the end of the first act is a nice solo by the soprano. And all of a sudden, the fellow behind me started opening up a candy, this wrapper, you know, classic. I thought, gee, you know, this is crazy. You can't wait 5 minutes for this song to be over. And it just kept... And, in the middle of it, he coughed. I think maybe to let everybody know that he was trying to keep things quiet, you know, because he was going to cough if he didn't open this candy or cough drop. But just... And so it just kept going on. And I kept thinking, well, should I just turn and let him know that I... hear him, you know, I've been shushed up in theaters before, you know, if I'm whispering, and it's, you know, it's not a great wound, you know, I understand, I, you know, so, you know, I wasn't going to be cruel, but, you know, should I let him know? I try to do body language, you know, like I'm really appreciating this music, so I would lean, I'd sort of swoon a little bit, you know, so I knew I was, you know, listening to the music, and then I'd lean forward. But it just kept going, and I ultimately didn't say anything. And so the lights come on, and I'm a little, you know, disappointed, and I turn as we all go out, and I see him, and you know, it looks to me like he doesn't even like opera. It looks like he just came along with his friends. And this is what I thought about him. You know, my opinion of him is he didn't even like opera. He didn't even like being there. He was waiting for it to be over. And so we had an intermission, go back, great second act, and at the end of the second act, it starts up again. The candy again, and I do the same movements. I get a little bit more disgruntled. I do the same body language, and so it happens twice. And I said, oh, you know, what's he thinking? This time I thought, you know, he was actually trying to, when the music was loud, I thought he was trying to open it. And when it got quiet, I thought he was stopping. So at least I thought he was paying attention. But still, he did it. And I couldn't understand why he could do it twice. And so the lights come up again. I decide just to sit there and calm down a little bit. So, you know, and they leave behind me. He leaves behind me with his friends. And I sit there and, you know, then it hits me. I mean, then the mindfulness bell goes off that I'm suffering. And I'm a Zen student. And I need to take some responsibility for my own suffering. I need to practice with my suffering. And I realize that I have not been receiving my life, that I've been rejecting his candy wrapping or unwrapping, that I've made a difference in my life, that in my life there are two things. There is the pleasant sound of the orchestra and the singing, and there's the unsavory sound of the candy wrapper. And this is the source of my suffering. I have separated the world into these two things. And so, you know, I actually live 99% of the time in the world of candy wrappers, opening candy wrappers, slamming car doors, the garbage collection here in the morning at 5:45 when we're trying to sit. So you know, I've practiced with sound before, and actually, I decided, you know, I live in this in a pretty noisy world that usually doesn't have opera in it, and now I should feel a lot better that there's some unsavory noise plus opera, so I'm better off. So I was feeling pretty good, feeling that I'm now receiving my life without rejecting. I'm a little more intimate with the causes and conditions that arise in my life. I'm separating the universe into fewer and fewer pieces, and so I'm feeling pretty good. So I'm sitting there, you know, waiting for the third act, and the fellow behind me hasn't come back yet. The lights are still up. And so I'm sitting there just kind of waiting. I get my program. I'm reading what's going to happen in the third act. And the candy wrapper happens. And it's the woman in front of me the whole time. And it's been playing with the candy. And not the poor fellow behind me that I made up the whole story about. Maybe he loves opera. And he certainly wasn't opening up the candy. And so I learned a lot about my mind, where it goes. So I figured that, you know, what I was using, Kokyo, was the storehouse consciousness that has all this stuff in it about where sound comes from and what candy wrappers sound like and what people look like who are appreciating music. And I just brought up all of those images, whether they were real or not. I used them all to make up this story about this poor innocent guy who actually did stifle a cough so that he wouldn't ruin opera for everybody. And so it was another way for me to think about the Yogacara practice. My mind played another trick on me on the train ride from back from Prague. You know, going from Vienna to Prague, I sat in a train car that was like our usual trains, you know, that kind of look like buses, you know, where there's a couple seats on this side of the aisle, a couple seats on that side of the aisle. There's the big windows on either side, and you look out the window and there's scenery on that side, there's scenery on this side. It's beautiful scenery between the two cities, so I really enjoyed it. On the ride back, I was in one of those cars that has, what are they? They're like little booths. There's another name for it, but compartments, you know, three seats facing each other on each side, kind of on one side of the train. And then there's the kind of a door and windows that kind of block you off from the aisle that's along the side of the train. So it's like the Harry Potter movies. You know, I'd never been in a train like that before. Maybe they're more European, but I was in one and I liked it. And so then there's the aisle, and then there's the other big window. So you look out one side, look through the window, and you see the scenery. And the other side, you actually look through two pieces of glass, the compartment glass, and then the glass on the other side. And, you know, so you look out that side, and you actually, because of optics, you see a reflection as you see that side, and you also see a reflection of the other side. And at the beginning anyway, before I realized what was happening, I would look out that side and I couldn't tell where anything was. When I realized that some of the stuff I was seeing was actually on that side of the train, it was a little confusing. But it was still, you know, kind of win-win, because actually you could look out one side and see both sides of the train. See all the scenery. So then I sort of enjoyed it. But it just made me think that, you know, it's kind of an optic trick and it's a mind trick, you know, just like I was making up stories about the poor guy behind me. Now I make stories about, oh, the farmhouse is over here, when, you know, it's really over there. So, you know, but that's what we do with all of our thoughts. You know, all of our thoughts are being reflected all over the place based on, you know, what our experience has been before. We make up stories about where things are, about what people are thinking. So it's a real lesson if we're working with really trying to be intimate with and not separate the world into pieces, when we think we have an idea about something being there, you know, the least we can do is say, not that. It might be something different. You know, if we have an idea about, you know, whether somebody likes opera and wants to be there, at some point we could at least say, that might not be the whole story. There might be something else going on. And that kind of breaks down the barriers. Even if we're you know, not totally intimate or not feeling totally intimate, at least we're at a point that we can negotiate. It might not quite be it. At least we're a little closer. Later on in the sutra, Manjushri asks, how does the Tathagata work? How does the Tathagata's mind work? How does Buddha work in the world? And there's a there's a corollary to that. How do we save all beings? You know, both of those questions are kind of about the same thing. The Buddha giving this sutra to the assembly talks about the Dharmakaya, the reality body of the Buddha, which is, you know, it's kind of tricky to talk about. It's not something that has form. It's not something we can point to or even get our minds around so much. So we're kind of on shaky ground just trying to figure it out or even talk about it. This reality body of the Buddha, one of the three bodies of the Buddha, Dharmakaya. But that being said, you have to say something. You know, I like to think of it as this reality body of the Buddha is, like I said before, the total dynamic functioning of the universe. Just that flow of the universe, all those causes and conditions, the source of you know, if there's any workings at all in the universe, you know, this is the source. And so how does this kind of formless energy flow of the universe, you know, how does that help us? How does that liberate us from suffering? Or how do we join it to save all beings? Of course, we're always a part you know, we're never outside of this total dynamic functioning of the universe. You know, I think there's some sutras and certainly some commentaries that equate the Dharmakaya, this reality body of the Buddha, with you know, Buddha nature. You know, this is that we're not separate. This is even our nature. Buddha in the sutra says that it's kind of this light, like the sun or the moon. It doesn't, you know, set out to identify us. Say, you know, I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you save all beings. It's just brilliant out there at all times, like the moon. Reb talks about that image of the moon reflecting on the water. The moon isn't saying, "I'm going to enlighten you, pool of water, Danube River in Vienna. I'm not going to create this glow on the Pacific." Right outside of Santa Cruz. It's not searching it out. It's just providing this light at all times. And it responds to our request. And And, you know, when seeking spiritual support is our request of the universe, is our acknowledgement of the light of the Dharmakaya, the light of the reality body of Buddha. When we say to ourselves, I'm suffering, and I've heard that meditation can relieve suffering. When we turn towards spiritual pursuits, our spiritual life, then we're meeting these blessings of the Dharmakaya. When we sit our 40-minute periods, when we're willing to loosen our grip a little bit of our ego and follow our breath, let go of our tight thoughts, and just be in our bodies, accepting the thoughts that come up, the person next to us that's coughing, the garbage collectors in the morning, when we're just willing to receive all of the causes and conditions of our life for these 40 minutes, then we're making a request that's being met equally by the blessings of the reality body of the Buddha. So can we, you know, what are ways that we prepare ourselves to be the Danube River that can be so illuminated, that can carry the light of the Dharmakaya? And we do that with our sitting, you know, with our acknowledgement that we're suffering. I'm suffering now, and I want to be liberated from suffering. I want to liberate others from suffering. That's the request that's met with equal force by the Dharmakaya. When I was in my hotel rooms in Vienna and in Prague, you know, all hotel rooms have TVs, and there's just one station that has that's in English, and it's CNN. It's this continuous loop of news and interview shows, and so, you know, I can turn on the news a couple times a day, but you know, there's not much going on. Or, I mean, there's a lot going on in the news, but it's not like you can channel surf because there's I can only understand the news. So on CNN one time, I caught this interview show with the young girl from Pakistan who got shot, Malala. And, you know, she was outspoken in her desire to go to school and really supported all children going to school. But in her town, specifically the girls weren't allowed to go to school, so she was outspoken, and she was shot and wounded because of her outspokenness, and she survived and doing very well. This was about a year ago that she was shot, and she's had many surgeries, but she is just, she is luminous. She is the reflection of the moon and water, and as much as I, you know, was grousing about CNN, it really caught me, this interview. So, you know, if you never heard of Buddhism, if you weren't really a spiritual seeker, you know, sometimes you meet people in life, you know, like Malala, and you just sort of say, I want to be like her. And that too is kind of the request, you know, and you say you want to be like her because, you know, you receive your life. You know, oh, she appeared on CNN. I'm receiving this. And I want to hear her. So maybe connected reasons, but maybe for another reason, the Buddha in the sutra says, just receive your life. Just practice not rejecting life as it appears to you, breath by breath, moment by moment, and receive these blessings that are around us all the time, you know, like sunbeams, like moonbeams. I'm ready to be met by our request to liberate all beings from suffering, to liberate ourselves from suffering. So there's a few minutes left. For any discussion, you know, how do you make a request of the universe, of the reality body of Buddha, to save all beings? What is the mindfulness bell that goes off in you, where you say, "Oh, this is suffering. I've separated the world into two pieces." We chanted that this morning. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinion for or against. The struggle of likes and dislikes is the disease of the mind. You know, Buddha is the great doctor. Our practices are medicine. When do you go to the doctor? When do you say, "Oh, this is suffering"? Any thoughts? Ziggy.
Thank you, Patrick, for your reflection this evening. It really illuminated an experience that I had this morning. I go to visit a woman that's over at Driftwood, next to her was a figure that in another time I might have had to walk out of the door, who I thought she was dead. It was a skeleton, really. I mean, there was no flesh. She was not under a sheet. And she was moaning. First when I first walked in, she wasn't moaning. She was laying back, her jaw was open, and I couldn't hardly look. At which point, anyway, I sat down with my woman I go to see, and the nurse was kind of in and out, and she pulled the curtain to separate us, because one doesn't want to look at something like someone so close to what appeared to be death. So I went to find a chair, and I went to a couple other rooms. One man wouldn't let me use his chair, and was very mean, and then I went in another room, and there's another man, and he reached out for my hand. I mean, this was an incredible experience this morning of what is separate and what is not. And when so I came back in to the woman I visited with her for a while, and here was the suffering. As she described, I can't get any sleep, she's moaning all the time, da 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 da. And when I was leaving, where my suffering was, I was going to leave. And there was a part of me that was saying, go say hello to this other woman. And so there was that moment where if I had walked away, I knew I would have been thinking about it all day and suffering. And instead, when I left, I went over to this other woman behind the curtain. And she had been moaning, and she turned as I went over to say hello. She stopped, and she turned, and she looked at me clearly. And I said, what is your name? Midge. And so I spoke with her for a few minutes. And, you know, it wasn't that feel. I mean, it was just like that is that opportunity where it's everywhere all the time. Mm-hmm. This invitation for intimacy, this invitation for really encountering that which I most did not want to encounter. Mm-hmm. So I attribute, all the practice of all the things that we all do to get to that place, but came away just, she blessed me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's a great story, and you know, really, really illuminates, you know, that, you know, you were apart, and then, you know, you were more intimate, and less suffering, and great, thank you. Carlos Castaneda says that spiritual life starts when we first start thinking about our own death. Mm-hmm. And maybe before that, death is out there. Death is to be feared and afraid of. And when we start thinking, oh, you know, this is me, and you know, that's the beginning of our spiritual life. This young luminary Malala says that she has no fear of death at all anymore. She was just this Pratyeka Buddha. You know, she was just glowing. And facing our own death is the beginning of our spiritual life, says Carlos Castaneda. Laurie.
One of the great things about, I also love opera, and one of the great things I think about opera is that it really is a unifier, because all people of all languages sometimes get together and listen to this opera, and language nobody understands, and we all just walk away and love it. I was in Italy. I don't travel very much, but I got to go to Italy. And I got to go to La Scala, which is an opera house. I also have an opera story. It's a typical of those European opera houses where they're, you know, very high and smaller. And we didn't have wonderful seats, but they were, I mean, they were up high and they were right over the stage, but they were at the front. So if you hung over the railing, you could really see most, about three quarters of the stage. So anyway, we were very happy. Their seats behind us were not such great seats. So the people behind us were, I think, French. I mean, I only speak English, so what do I know? But I think they're from France. I think they had never been to an opera before. They decided to come to this opera, and they didn't know how to act in an opera. Now, if you unwrap candy at the San Francisco Opera where I go, you don't do that, because that place is very well policed, and everybody would like turn on you if you did that. So you really behave. But apparently at La Scala, that's talking is like was okay. I couldn't believe that there was talking going on, but it's not okay with me. But anyway, so they were talking during the first act of the opera, and then somehow I don't know how I was communicating with them because they didn't really speak very good English. I think it must have been in English, but not very good. It indicated that they want to come into the space that where we were. There was like some spaces there. We would like to move into the spaces so they can see better. Which I'm fine with that. I don't care. I got my seat. What do I care if somebody's like right in there in the space? It didn't bother me in the least. But I said, that's fine. Just move right in there. But you can't talk. You have to be quiet. But I care about that. And so then they moved. There were like four of us in spaces for two with these extra spaces. And we were all happy as clowns. We walked out, we were thrilled. That was, you know, we were enjoying opera. It was fine. Mm-hmm. Good opera. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of... it's the music. It's the music that is the wonderful
part, I think. Yeah. And opera is about the great matter. Opera is always about life and death. And actually, opera used to be, you know, quite the kind of people's art form. Now it's a little bit rarefied, but it used to be the expensive seats now that are right there by the orchestra used to be where the kind of the free seats, and it was you know, quite filled with all walks of life. So it's got those roots. So that's one of the reasons I like it. Thank you. I was just thinking. We have to wrap up here, and. So I hope we can have more discussion in the house. I saw tea and cookies being set up in the house now. So thank you very much. May we devote the merit of our sitting practice tonight to the intimacy and non-separation of all things. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I to become it.